now, Father, the height of our aspirations, the depth of our existence. Thou who art the giver and sustainer of life, from whom all things have come, and to whom all things shall return. We beseech thy comforting presence in this hour of deepest bereavement. For our hearts are heavily laden with sorrow and remorse at the removal of one of history's truest representatives of thy will and purpose for mankind. While we pray for comfort, we pray for wisdom to guide our thoughts aright at this hour. For we, O God, in our finitude and limited vision, cannot begin to comprehend the full significance of this tragic occurrence. And so we raise the perennial question of Job, why, as we wait for the moment. Yet we are reminded by the best of the Christian tradition that in the total economy of the universe, good will ultimately triumph. Though sorrow tarries for the night, joy comes in the morning. We know, O God, that even in this little while of sorrow, we need not weep for the deceased. For here was one man truly prepared to die. In his last hours, he testified himself that he had been to the mountaintop, that his eyes had seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. We know he had no fear of death. Help us to find consolation in the fact that his life was a gift given to us at this crucial juncture in our history out of the graciousness of thy being. And so we had no real claims upon it. In the fullness of time, he came. And in the fullness of time, he has gone. He knew where he came from, and he knew where he was going. And so as we abide in this knowledge, our gratitude will abate our sorrow. We know, O God, that life is but a moment in eternity, and that he who lives for the moment will surely die. Yet he who lives for eternity and dedicates his life to those ultimate principles of truth, justice, and love, as this man has done, will never die. Inspire us to accept the imperative that his life so fully exemplifies, that we would not judge the worth of our lives by their physical longevity, but by the quality of their service to mankind. He has shown us how to live, O God. He has shown us how to love. Yet the manner of his teaching and the manner of his being was so strange and unfamiliar in our world, a world that abounds in war, hatred, and racism. A world that exalts the wicked and crucifies the righteous. A world where a word of condemnation is familiar, while a word of kindness is strange. And so this man was a peculiar man. He taught a peculiar teaching. So he was not of this world. So in the course of human events, the forces of time, fate, and the hopes of the oppressed converge upon a single man. Though once in a century the midwife of oppression snatches from the womb of history a child of destiny, the record of events testifies to the fact that history cannot bear the truth. We have witnessed the life of the crucified Christ, and we have seen the slaying of Martin Luther King. So like a wild, carnivorous beast that turns upon our own and devours them, history has turned once more upon its own, because it could not bear the truth that he spoke or the judgment that he wrought. And so, like Jesus, not only did Martin Luther King challenge the status quo, but he challenged our mode of existence. And therefore, like Jesus, he had to die as a martyr for a cause that challenged the world assumed posture of security. The light came into the darkness, but the darkness knew it not. O God, our leader is dead. And so now the question that he posed during his life frightens us in all its glaring proportions. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? We pray, O merciful Father, that the removal of this man will not nullify the revelation given through him. Undergird our feeble efforts with thy strength, and renew our courage to devote the full weight of our being to the ideas that he has thus far so nobly advanced. Deepen our commitment to nonviolence, so that this country will not be rent asunder by a frustrated segment of the black masses who would blaspheme the name of Martin Luther King by committing violence in that name. Grant that the Congress and President of this nation, who have been so generous and gracious in their memorial tribute, will be guided by the memory of this suffering servant and return to the legislative halls determined to pass without compromise or reservation legislation so vitally needed to preserve domestic tranquility and social disruption. Grant, O lover of peace, that we will effectively negotiate for a peaceful settlement in Vietnam, to end the brutal slaves and criminal atrocities committed in the name of democracy. Tune our hearts, O God, to hear and respond to the echoes of this undying voice of the ages, a voice of love and reconciliation in the present, a voice of hope and confidence in the future. And grant that in response to his sacrificial death, we will work towards that day when the long and tragic tone of man's inhumanity to man will resolve into a chorus of peace and brotherhood. Then love will tread out the baleful fires of anger, and in its ashes, plant a tree of peace. This is our prayer. Grant us thy gracious benediction.
The prayer was delivered by Reverend Ronald English, who is the associate minister of Ebenezer Baptist Church. The crowd outside Ebenezer Church became so large and so intense that it has now been reported that the march to the campus of Morehouse College has already begun, just to accommodate the people and to get rid of some of the jam of humanity. Yes, there it is. The march toward the Morehouse College campus has begun in order to relieve some of the congestion around Ebenezer Church. Lloyd Calvert?
The spectators moving through Atlanta away from Ebenezer Baptist Church, starting the 30 block or a little over 4 mile march from Ebenezer to the campus of Morehouse College for the public ceremony here. When they arrive here, they will join a crowd of several thousand that has
kept a watch in the night. The first several verses of the 90th Psalm, and now the nightingale of the Old Testament. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. For thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Just heard Reverend William H. Borders of the Fleet Street Baptist Church in Atlanta
Thank you. appreciate the effort, the struggles it took to get these laws on the settlement. We can reminisce the activities of the Finnish people back four decades ago when the numerous cultural and economic organizations mushroomed. The halls, cooperative stores and dairies, dramatic and athletic groups, choral groups and study classes first flourished, in which activity Martin participated heart and soul. He enjoyed singing and sports, but in all seriousness, was a builder and organizer amongst his fellow men. His goal was for a bountiful life on earth, not selfishly for himself, but for all of us. It took unusual courage and conviction to devote a big share of his life in the various people's movements, organizing and lecturing, for which he had natural abilities. Many were the months and trips that he lived out of a suitcase, and many were the years that his monetary compensation was very meager. We shall not overlook admiring his wife, Tony, who also had the stamina and conviction to stand by him, be the breadwinner and his inspiring spouse in those crucial years. Ironic indeed is the fact now that Martin did not live to enjoy and reap some of the benefits of his and his fellow workers' efforts. He had looked forward to a leisurely retiring next spring. For Martin, nature in all its infinite variety was an everlasting source of inspiration. He delighted and enjoyed himself with beautiful gardens of flowers. He grew the unusual yellow peace roses, which we could say indicated his heart and soul were dedicated to the ultimate peace in our world. Being a veteran of World War II solidified his conviction for peace. It takes great courage to fight for peace. A great pacifist during the First World War, Ralph Chaplin, at the gallows said, "Mourn not the dead that in the cold earth lie, dust unto dust, as all men must, but rather mourn the cowed and the meek, who see the world's great wrongs and dare not speak." We bid fond farewell to him who is gone. In death he found that which he sought in life, peace. May the peace roses from Martin's garden keep on blooming.
This message comes from Maribel LaFleur. "This was a man we remember now. He stood against the giants of monopoly, the slavers of his time, the hooded cobras of the Mesabi reign. Martin Mackey, we shall miss, of our time, of our land, dear and holy, that cradled him and is now his grave. We remember a strong and sweet man who illumined our destiny and the destiny of our country, and the road to the fulfillment of our people in our wounded land. This is our country, this is our children's land, and this is a man from our struggle. Remember this, he stood against the ravening power of steel at the time of the secret meeting in the landscape denuded by power and greed, of poor men walking from mine to mine, from far to forest, and greed was grinding the earth and man to dust, gutted in the open pit. Men felt like trees, women maddened by the bitter winters and by hunger. Remember, in 10 years, Carnegie, Frick, Morgan, and the Rockefellers took out $30 million from our land, brought over cheap labor from Finland, Poland, and Croatia, and took their bones and flesh and life. A defiant deed surpasses all argument. One man's look in the face of a tyrant, one flash of defiance, and all is resolved. When the people learn to remember, when the people shout out the names of the robbers, they will shout the names of the brave, the courageous, of those who led them in defiance. And the name of Martin Mackey will be shouted, sung, remembered. We will bring this fire into a new heart. Begin again, build the moist clay. Let the youth write down these histories, gleaned from modest and strong men. In the dark of history, let them light and wait and tend our agonizing seed. We do not say farewell now, but welcome him home to the global age and its struggle. This is our country, yes, towards which they shouldered the daily sun. This is our children's land. He helped ransom from greed and power, and he gives us purpose now again to struggle next year and all the years. He will appear in the young and eager, dreaming men, the pioneers again, choosing the path against the hurting power of death. And Martin Mackey, always in our land, we will dispel the frost of spirit and come forth under the strange, familiar trees of home.
Oh, Many of Martin's friends who could not be present with us today have sent messages to Tony. They say, we remember him dearly as a comrade in the struggle of the people of Minnesota. He did so much so modestly that he had the respect of all who knew him. Martin was always very close to us from the time we first knew him. And when I was with him, he seemed rather like a brother, one in whom I could confide in and would understand. We feel he will be missed by so many people who knew him and worked with him. Your great loss is also our loss. When the history of Minnesota is finally written as it should be, then Martin Mackey will be there, and will not be just one short paragraph. Martin was truly a man of the people. We have warm, treasured memories of Martin. When he visited our home, we shared confidences and reached the depth of understanding few people attain though they have contact all their lives. There were many, many messages of this kind I could not possibly read them all. Recalling the years I have known Martin, I first remember riding with him as he drove a co-op primary truck north of Virginia some 35 years ago. Again, only a few days before his untimely death, we rode together and talked of many things, past, present, and future. The span in between were years making history of excitement and progress. The world changing in 3.5 decades, perhaps more than it changed in the 3.5 centuries previous. Into those years, Martin crammed a full and rich life. None of us is able to separate the memory of the man from the times he lived in, nor the kind of man he was from the ideals he believed in and fought for. Martin was a modest man, although he could be proud of what he did. He was a warm and human man in his way with people, his friendliness and humor, an easy man to know as a friend. Perhaps once to each generation is given the opportunity to participate in one of those historic upheavals that move the whole nation forward. Of each generation, the men and women best remembered are those who recognize the moment of crisis before others do, who make their choice before the majority has chosen, and who march in full step with history. The years of the 1930s and 1940s were such a time of crisis in America. They were years of labor and farmers' organizations, of the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party, the Roosevelt New Deal, of social pioneering and progress. Martin identified his life with these crucial battles of our time. He is one of those who will be remembered. Today we read articles and editorials by the score about the necessity and value of dissent. They point out the historic role of minorities who dared offer a radical challenge to the status quo. Martin was all his life a dissenter when it was not half so respectable as today to oppose things that are wrong in our society or to propose radical changes and solutions. He was one of those who were called premature anti-fascists because they recognized fascism for what it was in the early years of Hitler and saw in Spain the first battleground between fascism and democracy. With the outbreak of World War II, Martin saw the same issues involved on a world scale and had no hesitation in going into the armed services, although illness cut short his active service. In the years since the war, I recall working with Martin on the first campaign to have Minneapolis schools hire Negro teachers long before the historic Supreme Court decision on school desegregation. I remember also the first serious effort to map out a citywide program of open housing. When the New Deal and war years drew to a close and were replaced by the era of Cold War and McCarthyism, many were disheartened or frightened into political conformity. Martin did not change his convictions or give up his unbounded confidence in the people. We're now beginning to see that even in the years of Cold War, setbacks were not permanent. Social legislation pioneered in the 1930s are now the accepted practice. Other beginnings made in establishment of civil rights and equality are stirring the whole country. The optimism and confidence that moved Martin throughout his lifetime are being confirmed. A new generation is speaking up, saying they have had enough of the mess in Vietnam, that they've had enough of the world as it is and want to make a new beginning. Each generation has a way of writing its own history, but each generation too finds inspiration in the past. The memory of Martin Mackey is part of the inheritance of the young, who after all will build the new world that must be built. Not all life, nor all memory, is written large in big events. They're composed, too, of a thousand small things and in the daily task of making a living. I remember Martin speaking and conversing in groups, large and small, and listening patiently more often than he himself spoke. I remember a warm May weekend of camping in Whitewater State Park. I remember him mowing the grass, planting trees and tending flowers at his lakeshore cottage. I remember his joy in his grandchildren and in relaxation from a week of work. I remember the days put in driving a truck during the last several years, and I know scores of men in auto body shops throughout Twin Cities, Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, who gave him their respect and friendship. Let us remember Martin for his warm humanity and identification with his fellow man, for this modest, unassuming, but steadfast devotion to a great cause. Let us remember him for his courage in holding to a dream, the aspiration for a better way of life for all mankind, a world without exploitation, poverty, and war. Let us remember him as our friend and comrade, for his joy in living and for his ability to make friends wherever he went and whatever he did. We, his innumerable friends who mourn his passing, are in ourselves a tangible part of the memory he has left behind him.
I never, I said he, I never
greater path to fill with
to march with him in Mississippi, to agonize and pray with him in the midst of the worst violence of St. Augustine, to spend many hours counseling with him, to go through great volumes of his private papers, organizing them, to spend many days and nights in his home. I know the innermost thought of this man as deeply as I know that of any man on earth. It has been the highest privilege of my life, this personal friendship. Martin Luther King spoke with the tongues of men and of angels. Now those eloquent lips are still. His knowledge ranged widely, and his prophetic wisdom penetrated deeply into human affairs. Now that knowledge and that wisdom have been transcended as he shares in the divine wisdom of eternity. The Apostle Paul has told us that when all other experiences and virtues of humanity have been left behind, faith, hope, and love remain. But the greatest of these is love. Martin exemplified all three in the rarest intensity. Amid the tempestuous seas and treacherous storms of injustice, hate, and violence which threaten the very life of mankind, his faith was a solid, immovable rock. He received hundreds of threats upon his life, yet for 13 years he walked among them unafraid. His single commitment was to do God's will for him. His trust was in God alone. On that rock of faith, God raised in him a lighthouse of hope. No white backlash, nor black backlash, nor massive indifference could cause him to despair. He dreamed a dream of world brotherhood, and unlike most of us, he gave himself absolutely to work for the fulfillment of this inspired hope. In that lighthouse of hope, God lighted in Martin a torch of love. He loved all men, even the hate-filled foes of all he represented. He tried sympathetically to understand. He sought to relieve the slavery of the oppressors as well as that of the oppressed. While overborne by incredible pressures upon his time and energy, he yet had time to bring comfort and counsel to a bereaved boy he had never seen before, or to park a car for a confused woman who was a complete stranger. What a legacy of love he has left to his faithful and gifted wife and these four dear children. They now share his dream, his faith, hope, and love. They and the faithful little band of nonviolent crusaders who have been unfailingly with him from Montgomery all the way to Memphis. They are too few. They who have already made such a costly sacrifice. It is now for us, all the millions of the living who care, to take up his torch of love. It is for us to finish his work, to end the awful destruction in Vietnam, to root out every trace of race prejudice from our lives, to bring the massive powers of this nation to aid the oppressed, and to heal the hate-scarred world. God rest your soul, dear Martin. You have fought the good fight. You have finished your course. You have kept the faith. Yours is now the triumphant crown of righteousness. Your dream is now ours. May God make us worthy and able to carry your torch of love and march on to brotherhood. delightful pleasure. For Mrs. Mary Gurley, a member of this church choir, to sing My Heavenly Father Watches Over Me. Mrs. Gurley, will you sing it once again for Martin and for me?
One salad,
And Martin took a small portion of that salad and left the other. And then she brought another salad, which was to be my salad. And he took a small portion of that. And she only brought one quarter of fish. And when someone reminded her that there should have been two quarters, he said, "Don't worry about it. Ralph and I can eat from the same plate." I ate my last meal last day.
This is the march progressing over the campus of Morehouse College. And even though the march has begun, you have seen in the pictures a few moments ago that there is still a tremendous crowd around Ebenezer Church. But now back to the Reverend Ralph Abernathy.
I will continue my fast until I am thoroughly satisfied and convinced that I am ready for the task.
Fasting, he's fasting.
Which is at hand.
Until he feels he's ready to take over King's lead.
Your prayer. Listen to him as he preaches. Christianity clearly affirms that in the long struggle between good and evil, good eventually will emerge as victor. Evil is ultimately doomed by the powerful forces of good. Good Friday must give way to the triumphant music of Easter. Degrading tares choke the sprouting necks of growing wheat for a season. But when the harvest is gleaned, the evil tares will be separated from the good wheat. Caesar occupies a palace and Christ a cross, but the same Christ rose up and split history in the A.D. and B.C. so that even the life of Caesar was subsequently dated by his birth. Long ago, biblical religion recognized what William Cullen Bryant affirmed. Truth fresh to the earth will rise again. Listen to him as he preaches again. And there are hard-hearted and bitter individuals among us who would combat the opponent with physical violence and corroding hatred. Violence. By creating many more social problems than it solves, never brings permanent peace. I am convinced that if we succumb to the temptation to use violence in our struggle for freedom, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to them will be a never-ending reign of chaos. And Martin preached, a voice echoing through the corridors of time says to every intemperate Peter, put up thy sword, for he that fighteth by the sword will perish by the sword. History is cluttered with the wreckage of peoples and of nations that failed to follow Christ's command. And he preached again. At times we need to know that the Lord is a God of justice. When slumbering giants of injustice emerge in the earth, we need to know that there is a God of power who can cut them down like the grass and leave them withering like the green herb. When our most tireless efforts fail to stop the surging sweep of oppression, we need to know that in this universe is a God whose matchless strength is a fit contrast to the sordid wickedness of man. But there are also times when we need to know that God possesses love and mercy. When we are staggered by the chilly winds of adversity and battered by the raging storms of disappointment, and when through our folly and sin we stray into some destructive far country and are frustrated because of a strange feeling of homesickness, we need to know that there is someone who loves us, cares for us, understands us, and will give us another chance. When days grow dark and nights grow dreary, we can be thankful that our God combines in his nature a creative synthesis of love and of justice which will lead us through life's dark valley and into sunlit paths of hope and fulfillment. And finally, he preached as did Jesus. You have heard it said to you as of old, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But a new commandment give I unto you. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you, and pray for them that despitefully use you. If you will do this, you will be able, as a black people, to bring into being a new age, an unborn generation will rise up and call your name blessed. For justice and equality for all men, Martin always wanted to get the staff in the mood for singing. And we would seek to sing our troubles away and bring joy into our hearts. We bring this service to a close now by singing one of his favorites. And then we will take his body from this sanctuary to the mule train which is waiting in front of the church and the thousands of impatient people who say that Martin belongs to them. And as I take the body to that mule train, I'm going to ask that Reverend English will remain and keep the congregation seated and the family seated until we have cleared the way out in front of the church. May we sing that favorite spiritual of Martin now. That we have the tape of his last sermon played to us now. Be there in love and in justice and in truth. virtue, best cooperation now. For there are thousands of people who have been waiting to make the pilgrimage to the quadrangle at Morehouse College for the final funeral service. And we want you to keep your seats now until the body is safely placed on the mule train. And then Reverend English will bring the family.
Congregating there as early as 4:30 o'clock this morning. So it is obvious that there is going to be a tremendous crowd on the campus of the college for the second services for the late Dr. King.
Chad, we're told that the governor of Georgia, Lester Maddox, watched the services on television. He said he would be too busy with official duties to attend himself. The marchers who went to Morehouse College earlier walked past the Capitol, Georgia State Capitol, and under Governor Maddox's window. There were about 10 helmeted policemen standing on the steps of the building, and there was symbolism, really. They were standing near a statue of the late Eugene Talmage, who was the governor of Georgia,
escorting
in the late 30s and early 40s.
King
and
all over town.
One of the outspoken advocates of white supremacy this country has known. Much has changed in the United States since then, and indeed a good deal has changed in Georgia. Partly, I suppose, through the efforts of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and
a team of mules, and then it was reduced to one because someone decided and concluded that one would be just as good a symbol as a team of mules. And so this mule, if it is there, has been borrowed. She is used for plowing, we understand, and for menial tasks on a farm near Atlanta.
There is a good deal of symbolism in this, I think. There were many references during the service to Dr. King's work as poor, needy, downtrodden, and the idea of using a farm mule to draw the wagon aboard which the coffin lies, obviously
white Christian
intended to
symbolize.
Around about the campus, Floyd, at Morehouse and along the route of march, from those sources, we're gathering a little bit more information as to the climate and what is going on. The funeral procession at Morehouse, as you've reported, is to move up a circular walkway just inside the main gate to the campus. And we have been told that two elderly women were discovered kneeling beside the walkway for more than an hour this morning in prayer. and a young woman held an umbrella overhead to shield them from the sun. The clouds began disappearing from the skies over Atlanta about noon, as you have reported, Floyd, giving additional color to the dogwoods and the azaleas on the campus. A young girl sat at a desk at the main gate reading a book entitled The Nature of Prejudice. Nearby was an honor guard of Boy Scouts. The marchers were 30 abreast for blocks when they reached the city hall. A police car driven by a Negro was at the head of the line. The marchers stopped for a moment in front of City Hall for about 10 minutes and sang the battle hymn of the Republic and let every moment ring. Many of the marchers are wearing mourning bands. One Justice Department official said to one of our reporters, "I haven't seen anything like this since the March on Montgomery." The Red Cross, we are told, has set up emergency clinics about every two or three blocks along the route. Each is staffed by a doctor and a nurse, and each is in radio contact with Grady Hospital in the event an ambulance should be needed.
Chet, adding to this crowd that is marching now,
concerning Mrs. King, James Farmer, one of Martin Luther King's finest and oldest friends, was one of the founders of the Congress of Racial Equality and served as its director until 1966. Under Farmer's leadership, CORE developed the sit-in and stand-in as non-violent weapons in the fight against segregation. Farmer is now president of the Center for Community Action and a professor at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. They say he was a close friend of Dr. King's.
Moment, the agony of a people, the agony of a nation and of a world, is precisely the agony of the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. It's the agony of a terrible dualism. It's the agony of a land where we can produce the hope and we can produce despair. We can produce the great dream of compassion of Dr. King, and we can at the same time produce the nightmare of hate which cut him down. We can grow a beautiful flower, and then we can trample it out. It is that dualism, that dilemma in the nation's life with which Dr. King wrestled all of his too brief life. The only fitting memorial to Dr. King is that now there be a great, massive, national commitment to solve this dualism, to bring the two sides of the nation's personality together. And together not in hate and division, but together in understanding. Understanding that the problems are great and severe, and that those problems must now be solved. We cannot wait, Dr. King shouted time after time. And he was right. It would be a disservice to him for us now to defer further the great dream of his. It would be just as much a disservice to our fallen leader for there to be more bloodshed and more hate in the wake of his assassination. Pray and work. We cannot love humanity, as King urged us to do, until we first, all of us, learn to love ourselves. But we cannot love ourselves unless at the same time we love mankind. The nation in this hour of travail must know that we as a nation, white and black people as people, are precisely what they do, in spite of any reservations they may have.
Now we can see the main body of the march passing Atlanta City Hall and turning the corner there.
Podium, we find that they have a lost child. But very shortly, the entourage should arrive at the college campus. played somebody, Ed Newman, I think, asked a while back for a crowd estimate, I think. And it's just an estimate. At the time that you asked, Ed, it was probably 30,000 or so here on the campus. And now I'm sure it has grown by another 5,000. But it has grown to the point where there is almost no space left. People are standing elbow to elbow. Those who are lucky enough to sit down are doing so, but the rest of the crowd is standing. We've been asking ourselves here in our position on the campus, just where are these people who are marching in next? And it, from the look of it on our monitor, it seems to be a tremendous number of people. Just where are they going to go when they arrive here at the campus? There is a little bit of space here and there that you can see, but it doesn't appear that there's enough space to accommodate what looks like about another 30,000. This is the Morehouse College Glee Club.